What we're going to be doing this evening is actually building on last week's lesson. You probably noticed last week how many times Paul referred in comparing his suffering to what Jesus went through. And he saw his life as simply a reflection of what Jesus had to experience. And so tonight we're going to be talking about the patience that Jesus had to display in the sufferings that he went through. We're going to start out this evening by just looking for a few moments at the fact of suffering in Jesus' life. And I feel that it's important we do this because too often it's easy for us to think, okay, Jesus came to this earth, he lived as a man, but he was still the Son of God. And so as a Son of God, he had kind of a built-in advantage that the rest of us don't really have. Yeah, he suffered, but, you know, he was Superman. You can't touch Superman, right? It's really hard for us to relate to what Jesus went through and how he experienced life. What I'd like for us to notice this evening, though, is that Jesus did suffer in every way like we suffer. In fact, this is spelled out in this passage in Hebrews 2, verses 17 and 18. Therefore, in all things he had to be made like his brethren, that he might be a merciful and faithful high priest in things pertaining to God, to make propitiation for the sins of the people. For in that he himself has suffered being tempted, he is able to aid those who are tempted. What I want us to emphasize here is he had to be made like his brethren in all things. When Jesus experienced suffering, it's the same kind of suffering that you and I have to experience. And I have just a few examples here. We won't go into great detail here. Two different kinds of suffering, emotional suffering and physical suffering, and of course Jesus experienced them both. Emotional suffering, I have a few specific examples. He suffered from the loss of people who were close to him in his life. This passage in John chapter 11 is best known as containing the shortest verse in the Bible. And what is that? Jesus wept. And what was the occasion of his weeping? When Lazarus died. In fact, the text tells us that as he saw all the other people, the friends of Lazarus, and the crying over the loss of their good friend, it touched him. He was deeply moved in spirit. And that was the occasion that led to Jesus weeping. So he knew what it was like to suffer the loss of a loved one. Also in Luke chapter 22 and verse 44, we won't turn and read that, but this is the story of Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane. And by the way, I'll give you a little heads up. This is what we're going to be studying in our Sunday night small group next Sunday. So if you're in town and part of the small group arrangement, we're going to be looking in detail at this passage. But this is where Jesus was in the Garden of Gethsemane. And do you remember what Luke's account says about the intensity of his prayer there? What was the language? He was in great agony, is the word that is used. And his sweat was like great drops of blood. I've had some pretty emotional experiences in my life where I was really deeply concerned about something, but I can't say that I've ever had that level of fear or dread of what was coming. So this idea that Jesus just skipped through life, being the Son of God, and he was more or less immune from the kind of really rough stuff that we have to deal with, that just doesn't square with the facts. Jesus was here a few hours away from what he knew was going to be a horrible death. And he had seen people crucified before, no doubt. That was his fate. This is what awaited him. He didn't want to do this. This was not going to be fun, not pleasant at all. And that's why, like any human being would, facing that kind of fate, he had that kind of deep emotional response to what was coming up. And then, of course, the emotional suffering related to rejection and ridicule, Matthew's account of his trial. What all did they do to Jesus prior to the actual crucifixion itself? Put the crown of thorns on him and a robe, and then they bowed down to him and mocked him as the King of the Jews, and they got a reed or a staff, and they'd strike him with it, put a blindfold on him, and then hit him and say, prophesy, who hit you? And then they'd spit on him, and just the mockery and the ridicule. Have you ever had somebody make fun of you? As a kid, no doubt, we all experienced that at some point in our lives. Well, here's Jesus getting it in spades as an adult. There had to be nothing fun or pleasant about this. It was difficult for him. All I'm saying is, if we ever experience something like this where somebody makes us a target and they really unleash on us, think of what Jesus went through. Is what you're experiencing as bad as what he went through? And even if it is that bad, Well, he was there before you. I mean, he knows exactly how you feel in going through that. And then, of course, there's the physical suffering that he experienced on the cross, where he was scourged. And it's interesting, the gospel records just mention that in passing. He was scourged, and then he was crucified. What did the scourging consist of? Bits of iron, or it ripped the skin off the flesh. It's a very painful, bloody type of punishment. And that's what Jesus experienced before he actually had the nails driven in his hand. How many of you saw Mel Gibson's The Passion of the Christ? Did you see that? It was rated R. Why? Because of the violence. In the depiction of what happened to him. If you haven't seen that movie, I do recommend that you see it, because it really gives you an intense feeling of what Jesus went through on that occasion. Again, the gospel records just rush through that and state very terse terms what happened, but when you can see it graphically displayed like this, it's just really wrenching to understand what he went through. So all I'm trying to emphasize here is that Jesus truly experienced suffering. He knows what it's like to go through this life and experience the hard edges of it. However, his suffering was not incidental to his purpose or mission in life. In fact, it was the whole purpose of his life. If you go back to the Old Testament, and I wish we had time to delve in these two chapters in depth, but we do not. Hopefully you're familiar with them. Psalm 22 is the psalm that was written by David and begins, my God, why have you forsaken me? Now, what did Jesus say on the cross? Those very words. He was quoting that psalm. And so when you compare the contents of Psalm 22 with what happened to Jesus, there are so many remarkable details. Things that Jesus personally had no control over. What his enemies were saying, how they were mocking him. It's just a fascinating prophecy of what would happen to Jesus on the day of his crucifixion. What's the significance of that? Why would the Bible give us a prophecy of the crucifixion of Jesus hundreds of years before it actually happened? Obviously, this is pretty strong argument for the divine origin of the prophecy and of Jesus and his mission and what he was doing. It also, I think, reinforces the fact that his suffering, what happened to the cross, this is part of God's plan. This was not just some one-off aberration of God's plan went off the rails here at the end and he had to scurry around and come up with some alternative afterwards. This was precisely what God had in mind when he sent his son to this earth. His ultimate fate as a human being on this earth is described in Psalm 22. Isaiah chapter 53, the description of the suffering servant. This is some 700 years before Christ. And so the prophet Isaiah is describing something, again, in language that is so remarkably descriptive of what happened to Jesus at his crucifixion. The thing that is expressed over and over in Psalm 53 is the idea that he was doing this for us. He was experiencing this for the transgressions of others. Our iniquities he bore in his suffering. Once again, we have another chapter that very graphically describes what happened to Jesus on the day of his crucifixion hundreds of years before it actually happened. And then when you get to the New Testament, it's very clear that his suffering was a key component of the gospel message that the apostles went out and preached everywhere. And I have three passages from the book of 1 Corinthians, and this is something that I had never really noticed before until we actually went through the Corinthian correspondence, I don't know, two or three years ago on Wednesday nights. And in that study, it just jumped out at me, something I'd never seen before, is how often Paul keeps taking the Corinthians back mentally to the story of Jesus on the cross. If they could grasp what that meant, what Jesus did on the cross, it would really shape the way that they were having to deal with the problems among themselves. If you had to single out one key problem that the Corinthian church was struggling with, it's really at the root of all the issues that they were fighting and fussing over, what would that one problem be? Pride? I was thinking of selfishness. They're each concerned about themselves. And so when you've got a group of people, especially from disparate backgrounds like they were, and each one of them is looking out for himself and his interests, then what's the inevitable result? Conflict, right? And so What is Paul trying to get the Corinthians to grasp, to get rid of this selfish spirit? What does he keep dragging them back to? In chapter 1, verse 23, we preach Christ crucified. In chapter 2, verse 2, determined not to know anything among you except Jesus Christ and Him crucified. Chapter 15, 3, I deliver to you first of all that which I also received, that Christ died for our sins according to the Scriptures. Paul just keeps hammering at this point. How many times do we hear today gospel preachers say, we need to preach Christ? Okay, what does that mean? And did Paul believe in preaching Christ? Sure. But at least in this context, with these people, it was what aspect of Christ? His sacrifice is Christ crucified. It's the crucified Christ. Now, how did the Jews respond to the idea of a crucified Messiah? Oh yeah, this is ridiculous. This is foolish. This can't be right. How did the Greeks respond to the idea of worshiping a crucified Savior? This made no sense to them either. You know, they're looking for some great general or philosopher, and Jesus just didn't fit any of these preconceived ideas that either the Jews or the Greeks had about who an object of worship ought to be. But Paul was insistent. Until you can grasp the idea of Jesus, of the Son of God, come to earth, experiencing what He went through in the form of this suffering and the horrible manner of His death, His crucifixion, until you can grasp that, you really don't have a handle on what the gospel is all about. It's really a warning to us as well today. It's important that we preach Christ, yes, but not just the fact that He was a good guy and went around doing good, all important, but the really most important thing is the fact that He was crucified, that He experienced this horrible suffering, just as we do. So what we're going to do now for the next few minutes, we're going to look at five reasons why the suffering of Jesus is important. The first thing we want to notice is that His suffering served as a substitution for our own punishment. And this is something that is just emphasized throughout the New Testament. I have three passages here that we will look at briefly to reinforce this thought. The first one is in Romans chapter 5, verses 6 through 10. Paul writes, "For when we were still without strength, in due time Christ died for the ungodly. For scarcely for a righteous man will one die, yet perhaps for a good man someone would even dare to die. But God demonstrates His own love toward us, in that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. Much more then, having now been justified by His blood, we shall be saved from wrath through Him. For if, when we were enemies, we were reconciled to God through the death of His Son, much more, having been reconciled, we shall be saved by His life." Two things that are really stressed in this passage is, number one, that we were not good people. We are not good people. We're enemies of God. We're ungodly. We're sinners. We are outside of any kind of relationship with God. And it's precisely because we're in that sad state that God sent His Son to die for us. He is the sacrifice that made it possible for us to be reconciled to God. 2 Corinthians 5 and verse 21. This is another one of the references, many references in the Corinthian correspondence that emphasize the importance of Christ and His sacrifice. This is the last verse of chapter 5 in 2 Corinthians. "For He made Him who knew no sin to be sin for us, that we might become the righteousness of God in Him." Christ knew no sin, but in His death on the cross, being punished as a criminal, what does Paul say was happening there? The substitution, vicarious suffering. He knew no sin, yet He became sin for us. He bore our sins on the cross. And then the passage in 1 Peter 3 and verse 18 is where Peter uses the expression, the just for the unjust. We're the unjust ones. We deserved what He got, but God had Him, a just man, take that punishment in our stead. And so many others that we could put in here. So I put this at the first because this is the aspect of Jesus' death that I think we're most familiar with. The idea that He died in our behalf, right? Died for our sins. This is really what Isaiah emphasized in Isaiah 53. But that's not the only significance to the suffering of Christ. His suffering was the pathway to the resurrection. Look at Romans chapter 4 and verse 25. He was delivered up because of our offenses and was raised because of our justification. Now, what's the delivered up referring to? Delivered up because of our offenses, that's referring to his crucifixion, his death. He's delivered up to punishment because of our sins. And in the same breath, Paul says he was raised because of our justification. What's the raising referring to? The resurrection. So when Jesus died on the cross, was that the end? When a lamb or an ox or a goat was sacrificed in the Old Testament, what happened to that lamb or ox or goat? Gone. The end. No more. Here you have a sacrifice that is made 3 days later. It comes back from the dead. Stop and think about this. Play this mind game, if you will. If Jesus tells his apostles, I'm going to die, I'm going to leave you, and they all grieve and they cry and moan and groan about it, he said, no, don't worry about it, it'll be okay. And so he goes in, lays down in his room on this comfortable bed and crosses his arms and he lays there and then a little bit, breathes his last breath. And that's it, he's gone. Now what do we usually say when somebody dies like that? Now, I know you've heard this expression, at least he didn't suffer. And then suppose 3 days later, from that kind of death, he comes back. Now that would be pretty dramatic, right, in itself. But that's not what happened here. When Jesus died, did he suffer? Horribly. His death was the most gruesome, bloody, violent way to go that you can imagine. Now why is that? Who is behind what was being done to Jesus? Who is really the driving force there? And be careful here. I understand it's part of God's plan, but really, who was the agent, the instrument that was really trying to make this the final defeat of God's plan? Satan. We use the expression of making an end of somebody or something so final that we drive a stake in it, right? That's what Satan was doing here. He's driving a stake into the heart of God's plan by having his son killed in a violent way. Except in this case, it was not a stake, it was Roman nails. Satan was pulling out all the stops. Everything he had, he threw at Jesus on this occasion to make his demise as total as possible. Even after he died and they put him in the grave, what did the Jewish authorities and the Romans conspire to do to make sure that there'd be no coming back? Posted guards at the tomb. Satan did everything he could to make this defeat of God's plan as complete and total as possible. Kill Jesus, eliminate him in the most violent way possible. And that's what really the crucifixion is all about. It is the complete, total defeat of God's intention. Except one little detail that Satan overlooked. The power of God to bring him back. 3 days later, he comes back from the dead. So that's why I ask you to consider the kind of death that we all desire where there is no suffering. Jesus could have died that kind of death, but how dramatic of a victory would it have been compared to the way that he did die, the very violent, gruesome, brutal way that he died, coming back from that? You see the point I'm making here? His resurrection from that kind of death, it really makes Jesus' resurrection all the more powerful. Think of the most unjust, terrible way that you could go from this world. What does God have the power to do? Bring you back. In fact, what did Jesus himself say? Don't fear those who can do what? Kill the body. Fear the one who can send your soul to hell. Serve God. All right, so his suffering then was the pathway to the resurrection. So when we talk about the resurrection from the dead, wow, we have something to build on. And it was the suffering that Jesus went through that led up to that resurrection that makes that resurrection so great. Third reason that Jesus' suffering is so important is that his suffering demonstrated God's solidarity with mankind. We're staying in the book of Romans. Turn over to chapter 8. Look at verses 31 through 39. Kind of skimmed through this. We actually looked at this in an earlier lesson. Paul is summing up in chapter 8 the benefits of the gospel. Those who come to God through Jesus Christ and the gospel, here's what they have to look forward to. Throughout chapter 8, he describes a number of these benefits, but as he comes down to the end in verse 31, he really uses some eloquent language to describe the beauty and the grandeur of this relationship that we have with our Creator that would not have been possible were it not for what Jesus did for us. He asked the question, what then shall we say to these things? If God is for us, who can be against us? We call that a rhetorical question. It's a question that basically the answer is built into the question. I mean, to ask the question is to answer it. When he says, if God is for us, who can be against us? Well, the answer is, duh, nobody. Because you've got God on your side, right? And there's nobody that's going to touch you if you've got God on your side. He who did, and here's the evidence he offers in verse 32. He who did not spare his own son, but delivered him up for us all, how shall he not with him also freely give us all things? Who will bring a charge against God's elect? It's God who justifies. Who is he who condemns? It's Christ who died and furthermore is also risen, who is at the right hand of God, who makes intercession for us. And he goes on describing the fact that God's people have victory assured. We have that to look forward to, right? Now, by the way, does that mean that if we surrender our lives to God in Jesus Christ, that we're immune from all pain from that point forward? Is that what Paul is saying here? Of course not. In fact, later in this very context, he says in verse 36, for your sake we are killed all day long. We are counted sheep for the slaughter. Verse 35, who shall separate us from the love of Christ? Tribulation, distress, persecution, famine, nakedness, peril, sword. Yeah, we're subject to all of those things. And Paul says, so what? We know what's on the other side. And what made that future reward possible? His sacrifice. And that's why I worded it the way I did here. His suffering demonstrated God's solidarity with mankind. If God is for us, who can be against us? You want evidence that God is on your side, that God is for you? What else does he have to do beside what he did in sending his son to die for you? Does that mean anything to you? Do you think that was easy for him? Do you think that pained him to see his son hanging there on the cross? And why did he do it? Because he loved us, right? Why would God bring himself through all that? I guess what I'm saying is, it's hard for me not to laugh when I hear atheists say, well, there can't be an all-powerful, wise, loving God who would allow all this suffering to go on in the world that we see around us, all this suffering and evil. This God that you're claiming isn't there, he took some suffering on himself at one point in history to show us, to convince us, guys, I understand. I know all about suffering. Been there, done that. So when we suffer as we go through life, when we turn our attention to Jesus Christ and what God did for us and his story, we have the assurance, yes, God does know. He does care. He does understand. And he will someday make it all right. God has solidarity with us and our suffering. Fourth reason why the suffering of Jesus is important is because his suffering qualified him to serve as our high priest. We read from Hebrews chapter 2 a moment ago. Jump over a couple of chapters into chapter 4. Look at verses 15 and 16. The writer says, we do not have a high priest who cannot sympathize with our weaknesses, but was in all points tempted as we are, yet without sin. Let us therefore come boldly to the throne of grace that we may obtain mercy and find grace to help in time of need. What's the role of a high priest? Certainly in the Old Testament religion. He's a go-between. He is one who stands between a holy God and impure human beings. And the high priest is a man in the middle. Who does he represent in that middle position? To the people, who does he represent? God. He's in the middle. And so both God and man meet in the work or the function of the high priest. And that's what the writer here is saying, that Jesus Christ is our high priest. But what aspect of the high priest's character is he emphasizing here in this text? He can sympathize with our weaknesses. He sympathizes with us. Therefore, let us come boldly to the throne of grace that we may obtain mercy and find grace to help in time of need. What gives us the boldness to come into the presence of God and ask for his help? And where's Jesus when we approach that throne? Yeah, he's right there. He's right there with us. In 1 John chapter 2, I think verse 1, describes Jesus as being our advocate with the Father. And that's actually a legal term describing a counsel for the defense, someone who can represent before the judge the defendant. And plead their case, speak for them. Jesus is our advocate. What qualifies him to be that advocate is the fact that he has experienced life as we have. He knows what it's like to be tempted. He knows what it's like to suffer. He knows what it's like to struggle through this life as we do. And because of that, we have confidence when we approach God that he's there at his right hand speaking in our behalf. And then the fifth final reason, the suffering of Jesus is important because the suffering gives us an example of how to patiently endure hardship. We've looked at this passage in 1 Peter 2 where Peter talks about the fact that we suffer, but look to Jesus and what he suffered, what he went through. And he is to be our example of how we deal with suffering. Very quickly, on this next chart, I want us to notice kind of a tie-in with last week's lesson, how the suffering of Jesus influenced Paul. One of these we looked at last week, but there are a couple of others. When you look at these passages all together, it gives you a pretty clear image of how Paul used the knowledge of what Jesus did for him as a motivator in his own life. I have been crucified with Christ. It is no longer I who live, but Christ lives in me. In the life which I now live in the flesh, I live by faith in the Son of God who loved me and gave himself for me. Galatians 2:20. I have been crucified with Christ. My life is gone. It's over. It's dead. I've turned it all over to him. Why? Because of what he did for me and his suffering. 2 Corinthians 5:14, 15. The love of Christ compels us because we judge thus that if one died for all, then all died, and he died for all, that those who live should live no longer for themselves, but for him who died for them and rose again. Which is precisely how Paul lived his life. It wasn't for him anymore. It was for Jesus. And then Philippians 3:10, that I may know him and the power of his resurrection and the fellowship or the sharing, the communion of his sufferings, being conformed to his death. Paul saw all the things that he experienced in his life. All the hardship, the adversity, tragedies, the pain, the hurt, all of that. He said, I'm just going through what Jesus went through. And we know how that turned out, for good or bad. For Jesus, how did it turn out, ultimately? Bad temporarily, but ultimately it turned out good, right? Yeah. And that's the way Paul is looking at it. Look, if Jesus can go through that, I can too. Nothing is going to stop me from finishing the course that the Lord has laid out for me. And so I'd like to end with this passage that we've already looked at a number of times in this lesson, back in 1 Peter 4. Beloved, do not think it strange concerning the fiery trial which is to try you as though some strange thing happened to you, but rejoice to the extent that you partake of Christ's sufferings, that when his glory is revealed, you may also be glad with exceeding joy. Have you ever thought about the hardships that you're dealing with in life as being partaking of Christ's sufferings? You're sharing what Jesus went through. So whenever you're looking at or considering or pondering the suffering that Jesus went through, think of yourself. My life ought to be a reflection of what he went through to some extent. All right, thank you very much. Next week we're going to conclude our series on how to develop a patient spirit. And we're just going to draw lessons from everything we've looked at.